Welcome to the Atonicast. I'm Ed Niedermeyer. I'm joined by my co-host, Alex Roy. Alex, how are you?
Hello, Edward.
Unfortunately, Kirsten Quarisite cannot be with us today, but we do have with us a very interesting guest from Toyota AI Ventures, Mr. Jim Adler. Jim, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What is the relationship between TRI and Toyota Ventures? Like, how does that work?
Toyota AI Ventures is a subsidiary, a wholly owned subsidiary of TRI. We're an LLC, structured like a dedicated venture capital fund. So when I was asked to lead the fund and get this thing set up, there are certain things that work well. Institutional venture capital works well. So we thought, because TRI is about innovation, not just around autonomous vehicles and robotics and materials, but also quote unquote, what's next for Toyota, we thought it would make sense to hang it off of TRI. But with all the venture capital, institutional venture capital structure, so we're a single LP fund right now. We have venture capital economics. We're financially aligned with our startup companies and co-investors around the idea that financial return is a prerequisite for strategic return. Everyone's aligned on success. So that's why we're structured this way. But we have this really wonderful added benefit of leveraging the TRI staff of researchers and engineers to help us understand where the spaces are in the technology, perhaps in the market. And they're also fantastic at helping us diligence companies.
So, Jim, you are a fan of Taleb's writing, Skin of the Game.
Yeah, I've read pretty much Taleb's books. I think all of them, actually. Certainly the trilogy of Black Swan, Antifragile, and now Skin in the Game, for sure.
And do you run into people who do not have Skin in the Game, who like to pontificate about what you should be investing in?
Yeah, I mean, I love Taleb's quote of "Don't tell me your opinion, tell me your portfolio." I think that says a lot about what I'm willing to commit to. Ideas are cheap, much cheaper than money or any other kind of currency. That whether it be your time, which actually is quite more precious than money, and that really that is a great indicator of what people really care about and really what they think. And I think gets to the heart of what Taleb's trying to convey in the book.
I actually have not read any Taleb. It seems to be incredibly popular with people who work in finance of different kinds. Is that a coincidence or not? It sounds like maybe not. I mean, the skin in the game concept seems very much tied to investing as a pursuit.
I think it started with, for me, Fooled by Randomness and Black Swan as an engineer who wanted to understand systems and how they worked and the stochastic laws that they're governed by. I really wanted to understand the underpinnings. Linear system theory is compelling, but it's a very narrow cast of systems, right? They say, linear systems or nonlinear systems are like calling animals non elephants, and so there is so much out there that we have not classified. And I think Taleb, for me as an engineer, it was about all this typical classical statistical theory you've been taught is really such a narrow, underdetermined set of theory that you really need to question everything that has a statistical underpinning. And that was really fascinating. I was a big fan of Benoit Mandelbrot and fractal and chaos theory, because I used to, you know, we're in the midst of a terrible storm on the East Coast. I grew up in Miami. I used to plot hurricanes when I was 8 years old coming across the Atlantic in Miami, just completely mesmerized by the systems that could create such a beautiful and devastating phenomenon. And this is what governs us. We're in this river that's tumultuous and then placid. And what governs all this? And it really does project onto the technology that we're bringing to market. And so it starts for me with engineering, but it sweeps through business and what will work and what doesn't work. And then ultimately, how it's going to affect our lives from a policy perspective, from a societal good perspective. And I think it's all connected.
I've been sitting here fascinated by your you know, the storm, the idea of tracking storms as sort of thinking about, you know, what you do professionally now as a venture capitalist. I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, there's a lot of sophisticated technology, more now probably than when you first were doing this as a kid, to track storms and understand sort of the different factors that are going into them. But at the same time, I mean, I've been, you know, in a city where a storm was about to hit and everyone was sure it was going to hit. And then it just didn't, it moved away, and understanding exactly why, you know, so you can have just huge amounts of data about this, you know, this system, but at the same time, it's such a huge complex system with, you know, where we understand the internal mechanics of it. So not poorly, but incompletely, that it can still behave like really unpredictably, even though we're able to, you know, track it and model it even like really, really well.
Yeah, I think the question is, it comes, you can understand something very well, but there's a level of predictability that you need to understand. If, you know, we keep on this thread of great literature from Raiders of the Lost Ark, never tell me the odds. So what are the odds that this phenomenon is going to happen? I always want to know the odds. I come from a long line of gamblers, and I remember my dad took me to the track, the horse track, when I was, I don't know, 11 years old, and it was very clear to me how to win, abundantly clear. Bet on all the horses. You'll definitely win. And then my father had to sit me down and teach me about odds and payouts, and I realized that the world was much more complex. And so a lot of the world is what you know, and understanding what you don't know and what the probabilities are around what you don't know, and pushing on things to understand how they work. I'm an electrical engineer, so I learned about impulse response in college, and I thought it was the most fascinating concept. Just hit something with a sledgehammer and see what it does. The example I love to use is, if you hit a skateboard with a sledgehammer, something will, it will pop. Do the same thing with a battleship. And you get a good idea of what the system dynamics are by whacking it. And I remember I was a few companies back, we were in this consumer, it was a consumer play. It was a digital product. And we were doing a bunch of A/B tests, trying to, of course, sell more of the product. And I was running the data science team, and some of the data scientists said, you know, well, we could just run this whole series of tests and testing all these fonts and colors and to get better conversion. And I said, how do we know that this will respond to any of the things we test? Is this a skateboard or is it a battleship? Can we even move it with any of these things that we're going to try? Because the ultimate battleship or skateboard is the mind of our customer, and we need to calibrate our efforts to the effect it will have on our customer. And I said, prove to me that these will have any effect at all, let alone the kind of effect we want. And that was really instructive. Before we spend a lot of money, a lot of time, you know, going through, you know, everyone's, I remember in those days it was, well, you know, Google tests 40 different shades of blue on pages. And I said, well, does that matter for our business? Doesn't matter if Google does it, may work for them, but let's calibrate to our problem. And I think those are good questions to ask no matter what the discipline, what the product is, and what the ultimate measure of success might be.
What you just said there was, it seems a little bit different than what I might expect to hear from a venture capitalist. It seems like VCs like to sort of take in, you know, look at as big a picture as possible and sort of feel as unconstrained as possible to find those, you know, little things or whatever. But the situation you're in now, I mean, you're working with Toyota. I mean, you're working for Toyota, and you're essentially, if I have this right, you know, sort of filling in some of the you're serving their needs. So is that fundamentally different than sort of a traditional venture capitalist position? Like, are you more constrained? And if so, it sounds like that's not a bad thing from your perspective.
You know, I don't think we're all that constrained. I think that we are Toyota's first separate structured venture capital fund, focused on early stage deals, seed, Series A, in AI, data, cloud, autonomous mobility, robotics. Pretty broad investment thesis. So there is this precision and recall idea, right? So cast a big net. Is important, and then understand what goodness is, and so we want to cast a wide enough net, and I think with that kind of investment thesis, we've been pretty open to all kinds of things. Like we invest way beyond cars, for example, right? We do a lot of robotics investments and underlying technologies around AI and data. So we feel that the net is big enough. Then the question is, okay, what does success look like? Which is the convergent part. So the investment thesis is the dart, cast a big net, and then the success criteria is the convergent part. And because we're a corporation, we have both strategic returns and financial returns. The experiment we're running, and that I feel quite strongly about, having been on the other side of the table as an entrepreneur most of my career, is that financial return is actually a prerequisite for a strategic return, because startups are experiments in the marketplace, and we want to understand those startups and the experiments that they're running. We want to understand what works, and if they're successful, that tells us that the market's valuing that either technology or business model or approach to solving customers' problems. We don't always know that going in. You know, the second guess is never wrong. The first guess is hard. And startups are uniquely suited, I think, better than large companies like Toyota to make that first guess.
When you make an investment, though, you know, are you imagining already the relevance that this is going to have to Toyota, you know, in the future? Or is it sometimes where you find a company, or you find a technology, or you find a product even, or whatever, the success of that, you may not understand how it connects to Toyota's strategic aims as they exist right now, but you just, you have to always be imagining that connection to the strategic goals of the bigger company?
Not necessarily. We often have in our investment board meetings discussions, I would even posit arguments, and they're good ones, around strategic benefit and financial benefit. As I said, I maintain they're intimately linked. But venture capital is about bigger bets. And if you look for incremental gains, you shouldn't be doing venture capital. You should be just doing only proofs of concept or buying interesting products if you're trying just to help today's business. In many respects, what we are aiming for is to figure out what might be next for Toyota. As you know, Toyota started as an industrial loom cloth making company, and they pivoted to cars in the 1930s. Not a bad pivot, I think, by all measures. But given the level of disruption in the automotive industry of late, another pivot may be necessary or beneficial or advantageous, and we need to figure that out. And that's what, in many respects, that's what this fund's about. So I kind of look for a little crazy. We want to find some crazy. You know, I heard the discussion of the hype cycle that you guys did a few weeks ago. And because I used to be an enterprise software, I'm very familiar with the hype cycle and with respect to enterprise software. And now it's kind of come to automotive, which is really, really fun to see. And we are definitely in this hype cycle. We can debate on where we are and how that informs our investment decisions. But we know things are going to change radically, and we can't predict them. And so we want to invest in companies that are looking pretty far out. And that doesn't mean incremental to Toyota's current business.
So I'm looking at the portfolio companies of AI Ventures, and I understand you guys are only like, 15 months old? Is that right?
Yeah, July 2017.
Okay, so there's 9, 12, 13.
There's 13 total. We've announced 11.
So the two that have been unannounced, are those in the micromobility space?
I would love to tell you that, but I'm not going to.
Well, because, you know, just thinking, there's been a lot, obviously, the last, you know, few months have been dominated by micromobility. Mm-hmm. Toyota's the parent company. Mm-hmm. You've got some other really interesting investments. Can we walk through a couple of these? Because I'm curious.
Yeah, absolutely. Would love to.
Joby Aviation.
Yes.
An electric mobility company doing a fully electric VTOL passenger aircraft. So how is this differentiated from so many of the other flying taxi stories we've heard?
Well, I think we were really impressed with the team and their experience, both on the vehicle side and on the commercial side. So between Joe Bembevert, who's been doing these kinds of vehicles for decades, and Paul Chiara, who's co-founder of Pinterest, we felt like, okay, this is an amazing team that is tenacious and is moving incredibly fast to bring this to market. So we felt that they had a lead that we were impressed with. And this was one of those where we did have the conversation about how disruptive could this be for Toyota. You don't know how it's going to play out, but you know that we can only build so many roads. And in many urban areas, we're done. We're done building the roads. So the only place you can go, we have to go upward, not northward.
Right.
So I think that this is just a no-brainer. We can debate the timing, the financing, the capital requirements, all these things, which I'd love to debate. But you know it's going to happen. It's sort of like when they asked Bezos, you know, how did you know? How did you know the future? He said, well, I knew a couple things. I knew that customers would always want fast delivery and more variety and lower prices. That I knew was not going to change. The future would hold that. And I just spun up flywheels to deliver those things. I think people are always going to want to go places faster at low price with, of course, as safe as possible.
Funny, no one ever loses money betting on human nature.
That's right.
So that's 11 companies, but out of the 11, two of them are in home robotics and wellness. You've got Intuition Robotics, I know a little bit about. Mm-hmm.
In fact, we've recorded an episode with them, and actually it just occurred to me, I think we may run that in parallel with this.
Oh, cool.
We haven't run it yet. And so maybe we'll – I feel like it would be great to kind of have you and then them just so people can kind of get a sense of the companies you invest in.
Yeah, Door's great. We love Intuition Robotics.
So what does Embody do? It talks about wellness for families.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I can't say a lot about Embody yet. Okay. They mm-hmm. are very stealthy, but the founders are incredibly well, you know, really experienced in the area. Having done worked for iRobot and others, Maya comes out of USC and just incredible understanding of people and what robots might resonate with consumers, with people. One thing that's fascinating about the robotic space and that we found, I think, is Toyota uniquely positioned to appreciate is for us. Robots are not just people substitutes. And if you look at the Intuition Robotics offering, LEQ, it doesn't look like a person. It looks like more of a lamp, more of a piece of furniture.
Or like Eva from Wall-E.
Yeah, right. and I think a car doesn't look like a person, but we have this deep passion of cars. And Toyota, I think, uniquely understands the human being's connection to objects. And I think that is the key to understand bringing robots to the market. If you understand cars, and I know you folks do, cars are about amplifying our agency in the world by helping us move where we want to go. It's about freedom. It's about agency. And I think for that, we have incredible affection for cars. And I think that is the gestalt of what I think successful robotics companies will bring, at least in the consumer space. I think in the enterprise space, it might be more utility, but certainly in the consumer space.
You're using a lot of the same language that we hear from, you know, our mutual friend Gil Pratt at TRI. I mean, how much of the, I guess, the approach about augmenting human capabilities as opposed to replacing people is, does that guide all your investments, or is that really a TRI thing that you also believe in?
Well, I think Gil's on our investment board, right? I spent a lot of time with Dr. Pratt, learning at his knee. So I think there's an incredible amount of understanding and experience and deep thinking about these issues. It does inform our thesis of what we think will be successful. From my perspective, this isn't just an academic exercise. For Toyota, it's not an academic exercise. The academics certainly inform our direction, but at the end of the day, this has to deliver real value for our customers and ultimately our society. So that's what goes into deciding what kind of deals we do.
So would you be opposed to a humanoid robot servant indistinguishable from a person?
I think it opens up a lot of philosophical and societal questions, of which I don't have the answers to be honest. I think that's what we're figuring out. We have a hypothesis. You can figure things out a couple ways. As we talked earlier, you can have a fully constrained model that predicts the future, like ballistics, right? Kinematic equations will tell you exactly where a cannonball will hit, given its exit velocity and elevation angle. So that's completely constrained. These problems are not constrained. These you have to run an experiment, and you have to take your data, and then you revise your hypothesis. And I think that's what's going on. And we've all seen those science fiction. We've seen Blade Runner. Do we want indistinguishable androids running around? And at what point do these beings, these objects, pass through into the realm of our society, and what role will they play, and what kind of position will they hold? That's the brave new world that we're figuring out. And what I think is important, and I talk about this and write about this a lot, it's important that we do this in parallel, not serially. And what I mean by that is you often have the technologists figuring out the technology, and then you have the business people figuring out how to make money from it. Then you have the policy people clean up the messes, what I affectionately call as the geek, the suits, and the wonks. And I think that whether it's autonomous driving or robotics, and really autonomous cars are just really large wheeled robots, we're going to have to do this technology innovation, business invention, and policy understanding simultaneously in parallel. In fact, we have no choice. Unlike social media, where we kind of ran silent, ran deep for a long time, and now we're sort of grappling with some of the policy implications, you're not going to have that luxury with either autonomous driving or robotics. It's going to happen in plain sight, and we're going to have to deal with the policy implications as they emerge, which is a good thing. I think that's why I'm so optimistic about this direction.
We've spoken together in the past, and I've heard you speak repeatedly about these serial versus parallel conceptual approach, and Gil's spoken of it. But it seems like a lot of venture capital funds are very much, a serial mindset, looking for moonshots all the time, and not considering how many problems or can be solved using AI to develop parallel solutions. This trough of disillusionment we see in automotive, are we going to see that in a lot of other sectors where people are trying to apply AI via moonshots and fall short and then come back to solve problems in a parallel way?
Well, I don't think the trough of disillusionment is a bad thing. I think what we see is it's human nature. We always try to push it. That's part of the innovation process. You push it, and you get pushed back. You get pushed back by the technology. You get pushed back by the customer. You get pushed back from policy folks, journalists, economists. That's how you innovate. And so when I look at from a VC perspective, the inflated expectation part of the hype cycle, that really just only affects price, Now, price is really important, but it really fundamentally affects price. When you invest, you really, I would argue, invest for the slope of enlightenment down the curve, because that's where the value is created. You need to make sure that you don't overpay so much that when the slope of enlightenment comes, and assume it comes at, in a timely fashion, that the value created will never give you the return on the price you paid. That's a failure. So you have to watch the price you paid. But I think we always expect that the trough will come. And the good news around the trough is that the slope of enlightenment and ultimate value to society, to customers, and ultimately to your investment will be realized.
So peak hype,
it's not a bad thing.
And the trough of disillusionment, I mean, it's kind of the signal, right? I'm sorry, it's kind of the noise, whereas the slope of enlightenment is sort of the signal. Is that how you look at it?
Yeah, I mean, these things are underdammed, right? to use a system theory idea, right? So it rings, right? The market rings, and then it settles down to something, and so you just have to recognize that the ringing happens, and everyone kind of to overload the term, wring their hands every time they say, oh, this thing's getting so hyped up. Well, then don't invest. And there's certain deals that we certainly haven't invested in because the price was just too high and we didn't see that the return could be there. We didn't have faith that it would be there or that it would take too long. So the ringing is good. And yes, you can view it as noise, but I think it's just the dynamics of the system to actually find the value. Think about if you did, and this gets to, we talked about Taleb earlier. Anti-fragile is about signal. It's about, and there is signal in the noise. If you had to throw away the signal with the noise, I think I would always rather take the signal with the noise and have no signal at all. And so the hype cycle, yeah, there's noise, but there's signal in there too. And that's how you find the value.
So you've done a really great job of, I think I understand now where robotics fit in with what you do better than I did before. I was always a little bit not 100% clear about what role that played. What I'm really curious though about is you actually put out a call for specifically home robotics. So our first call is designed to spur innovation in robotics, specifically mobile manipulation technologies for assistive robots that help people in and around the home. And we're looking to invest up to $2 million. Why did you approach this way? Why put out a call at all? But then also maybe specifically, why put out a call for robotics?
We were a little disappointed in the level of robotic entry into the home, or robot entry into the home. And really, it's about mobility and manipulation. And I remember when I was an entrepreneur, other side of the table, I needed some signal. I needed to understand what people cared about, where they thought the market may be going. And yes, I read all the blogs of journalists and venture capitalists and to try to understand, and my customers, of where they thought the market would be going. In this area, we saw, and this was really in partnership with TRI, we have, leading engineers and researchers in robotics here, and they've been dismayed by the level of market entry of these solutions into the home. So the idea is to give entrepreneurs and potential entrepreneurs a nudge in direction and a nudge in capital to help them see how they might be able to take what they have, their technology, their business acumen, their tenacity into this space. And we wanted to vote with our investment dollars to actually run that experiment in order to flesh it out. And so that was the genesis of the call. And it was, and when we conceived of the fund, and this really comes from Gil Pratt's experience at DARPA, how can you help the marketplace figure it out? And could you take a more active role? And of course, Gil's storied past around the DARPA challenges really has informed a lot of that. And so this call for innovation, first around mobile manipulation, in the home is the first entree into that strategy.
Why do you think you were disappointed by what was out there before making the call? Like, is it that that the talent has been sort of all sucked into self-driving cars in robotics, or why do you think that is?
I don't know, but where's my Rosie the Robot? You know, I mean, it's sort of like the picture phone that was in my world book, you know, when I was, 7 years old. I didn't get my picture phone until 2006 with the iPhone. These things tend to, there's all kinds of fits and starts as these technologies move into products and the products move into the market. And it depends on a lot of things of when things are ready, when technologies get to a point where they're either efficient enough, technically sophisticated enough, and they have a set of product people that could pull them all together and get it to market. I don't know. I mean, yeah. I mean, the sucking sound of talent into autonomous vehicles has something to do with it. I don't really think so. I just think that hardware is hard, as you've heard many, many times, I'm sure. And doing hardware and bringing it into the home, finding a use case that actually makes sense, that's doable, that's that solves a real problem for real people, that's hard stuff. But isn't that what venture capital is about, is taking these kinds of risks, at least partly?
Well, it seems like if demographics are destiny, right? I mean, you know, especially in the wealthier developed markets, right? Like populations are aging. I mean, it seems to me that you know, an entrepreneur who's sort of looking at the big picture, you know, sort of where technology could go, and find markets specifically. And I think especially the combination of being able to help people make the world a better place and actually have, you know, strong chances at a good, you know, financial performance, seems like robotics to assist elderly people, like there's a huge opportunity there, right?
Well, you work on my side of the street, so yeah, exactly right. I mean, you look at and just because there's been minimal progress to date doesn't mean in 5 years we're going to look back and say, wow, look at all these robots that are now in the market, either as consumer products or as enterprise products. Intuition Robotics is a great example. It's the reason we love what Dor and his team were doing is that they knew what they needed to develop and they knew what they did not need to develop. So they were very focused around a proactive assistant, a companion for a specific market, a very thin end of the wedge go to market. I tell entrepreneurs that, you know, boiling the ocean is not a go to market strategy. You can't do everything for everyone immediately. As is often said, startups don't die of starvation, they die of indigestion. And don't do too much. And Dor and his team, they just were laser focused on what they had to develop for the people they need to develop it for. And that's, I think, is part of the alchemy of having a successful product. And they are dutifully, one step at a time, tenaciously pursuing that goal. And they've developed an incredible stack of technology that we actually think might have application even beyond their first market of older adults.
Cool.
Well, we have to wrap it up soon.
We do.
But I have a last question, then Ed, I'm sure you've got a bunch more. You have this essay where you talk about Kodak,
yeah,
and disruption and them not seeing the future of digital photography. I own an 18-year-old Sony Aibo robot dog, which costs $3,000 in 2000. So adjusted for inflation, that's a serious piece of kit, which is it's very limited in its functionality, but was a really lovable little thing. So 18 years later, they have come out with a new model, which it does basically nothing new. Why is it that companies like Sony, which have almost unlimited resources and this epic history making consumer products, that they just can't, that they can't seem to touch the pulse of what people might want?
Well, I can't pretend to speak for Sony, but I think that the research is clear on why large corporations have a hard time innovating in a disruptive way. I think that, and this is a lot, of course, Clay Christensen's work on Innovator's Dilemma and S-curves. And I think that large companies are focused on the business at hand that is generating the revenues and earnings that sustain the business. And what they tend to do when they see an insurgent company or come in, or insurgent companies come into their industry, they tend to do what they've always done, which looks incremental because they're not used to taking big bets. And they think by doing what's they've done incrementally, they could intersect the new S curve that the insurgent is enjoying and capture the market share that the insurgent is enjoying. And that never works. I use the example in the talk you mentioned, Alex.
Never?
Next to never. I mean, the best one I've seen do it is Amazon. I mean, Amazon has figured out how to disrupt itself. And I think that's because there's a separation between the teams at Amazon. I spent 20 years in Seattle and watched AWS grow up alongside Amazon.com. And Jeff Bezos is amazingly focused about capital allocation and separation of the teams. And then, you know, like magic, 10 years later, Amazon Web Services is the dominant profit center for Amazon. And as Bezos famously said, 10 years in the making. And I think that, that's the really the only example that I'd love to hear others. But Kodak isn't the only example on the other side. If you look at Nokia and IBM and GE and RIM, I mean, they've all struggled on finding what's next. And it's this inability to find that crazy idea that someone's willing to stake their career around. I think our leadership at Toyota gets that, which is why TRI is a separate company. It's in the Valley. It's led by someone out of robotics that spent time at DARPA. Why AI Ventures is a separate company with a separate mission. And we're not car. I mean, I'm not a car person. Gil is. I mean, he did the whole the DARPA challenges, but he's never worked at a car company to my knowledge, and neither have I. I'm in year three in Toyota. I'm an entrepreneur. I am here to be the happy warrior and look at things that could be disruptive for Toyota in the midterm to long term. That's my job, and my job is to bring entrepreneurs to the company, and we get a front row seat to the crazy ideas that they're tenaciously bringing to market, and let them do their thing. Don't try to control them. I remember early in my career, I had Cisco as one of my investors, and John Chambers said, "Just go do what you do, Jim. If you change the market, if you bring something disruptive, we may bring you into Cisco," which, you know, Cisco has a storied history of that. Clearly, that did not happen. But it was an experiment. It was outsourced R&D, really, and really outsourced business innovation that some of the companies in the Valley have figured out. And the auto industry needs to learn.
Wow. Well, that's a great place to wrap up. Where if people want to, you know, follow you, follow your work, a website, maybe a social media account or multiple. I know you guys you write on Medium. Mm-hmm. Just give people ways to kind of keep track of what you do.
Yeah, so you can find Toyota AI Ventures at toyota-ai.ventures. We have a Medium blog. I also blog on Medium at Jim Under Adler. I'm on Twitter at Jim Under Adler. And I think those are, and always LinkedIn, of course. You can find me. Google me, Jim Adler. When you Google Jim Adler, you will either find me or you'll find this this Texas lawyer. I am not the Texas lawyer.
Texas hammer.
I am not the Texas hammer. I'm the other guy.
Cool. Well, Jim, thank you so much for taking the time. This has been really, really interesting. We appreciate you coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. This has really been a lot of fun.